Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this new episode of the Metropolitan Mobility Podcast. My name is Geert Kloppenburg and I've got around about 17 years of experience in this field of mobility. And we are interviewing somebody today who is like a visionary and who knows everything about urban planning, architects, so many things. But before we go to our guest, I want to introduce my favorite sidekick, Karin ten Hage. She's got round about, I don't know how much years of experience in this field. I think round about 10, Karin, with TNT, with data and logistics, and with doing this whole mobility as a service thing. Yeah, Karin, what is this series about?
So the fun is in actually sort of envisioning a radical redesign of the mobility system. So what if we would start with a clean slate and take all the technological developments and everything that's going on right now, and we throw everything in the mix and we start developing from there? So what could a mobility system look like? And I'm not just talking about people, but I'm also talking about freight or parcels or anything else that actually is transported in and out of the city.
Okay, cool. We've got on the other side of the world our guest, Carlo Ratti. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, and I'm very good to be with you.
We wanted to do a proper introduction, and Karin do a proper introduction about what Mr. Ratti, or let's say we say first name Carlo, but what he actually has done, then he doesn't have to do it himself. Like, what is like CV, and where? Can you just say a couple of sentences before we go into all kinds of things? But what has he done? What has Carlo done?
I've been preparing for a few days, but to actually give credit to this entire man's resume, we'd need like four more podcasts, because he's done so much. And maybe sort of in relation to this particular series, the work that you're doing in the Sensible City Lab, but also that you're doing with AMS, the Amsterdam Institute for Advanced Metropolitan Solutions, I think are super relevant. And you've done a ton of other things. So I'd really, this time, would like to sort of turn it around. And what would you consider your most relevant experience when it comes to redesigning mobility, Carlo?
But you know, we are passionate about design innovation. And we do this both in terms of research, of course, with AMS, AMSA Metropolitan Solutions. They've been very exciting to work with all of the team at TU Delft and Wageningen over the past 3-4 years. We're doing that clearly with research at MIT both in Boston and with a small lab in Singapore. And also with design, with our design office, Calorati Associati, based in New York, in Italy, in London, where we look at how this can actually become a design that can change, you know, a neighborhood, can change a city, or also the smaller scale, you know, at the scale of a building or objects. And so we're passionate about design innovation, and clearly, today, mobility is one of the spaces that's changing very, very fast. And so that's one of the spaces we've been looking at quite a lot in both in terms of research and design.
We always look for a concrete project. Let's start off with the New Deal Paris. That's like redesigning the périphérique, the world famous périphérique in Paris. Can you just in 3-4 sentences say, how do you start such a project?
Yeah, so, well, we were very excited to do this. By the way, this was one of our design projects with our design office with Calorati Associati. And that was as a response to a request by the city of Paris to try to reimagine the infamous périphérique. And the infamous périphérique is basically the urban highway in Paris. I say infamous because, you know, it's often congested, a bit like, you know, most cities have, you know, urban highways, you know, they've been an issue. Here in Boston, for instance, where I am today, there's the highway running through the city, and it took around 20 years in order to solve it and to address that issue and to build above it and so on. So in Paris, the city, the mayor actually ran this kind of competition, this kind of project to look at how this could be converted. And what we try to do was really look at how new mobility can help us change the space. And if you think about the issues of an urban highway, traditionally, is that, you know, you're cutting the city in two parts. It's very difficult to connect. And so how can you connect again? Well, the good news here is that, first of all, we're going to get much more electric mobility. This is already happening now, and you know, it's going to happen more and more in the next few years. And also, we are going to see more and more autonomous driving. where the combination of EVs, electric vehicles, plus AVs, autonomous vehicles, or self-driving vehicles, is most likely going to change the way we use this infrastructure. And so what we did in this project is explore how things could be a few years from now. And just to give you a few things, for instance, you know, the very simple thing that we're going to have less pollution next to the peripheric means that we can actually build closer to it. We can use the sides to do other things. We can run, we can have bicycles closer to cars. Also, if you're able to make this safer, hopefully, you know, AVs, autonomous vehicles, are going to make mobility safer. So it means we can use this in a more flexible way. You know, I would say that flexibility is a very important thing, because the problem with the mobility infrastructure today is not about capacity overall. It is about peaks. It's the same problem as with coronavirus. The problem is about the peak. If there is a peak and the hospitals cannot have enough patients, then it's an issue with the pandemic. In a similar way with traffic, it's not about overall capacity. It's about peaks when everything gets congested. So actually, if we can use our infrastructure, program it in a more dynamic way, then, you know, we can actually address peaks and use it much, much better in a more sustainable way. So again, in this project, we, first of all, as I was saying, we use the peripheric more in order to use it closer to the road for different type of activities, for sports, for other type of mobility, also for buildings above in order, you know, to bridge across it. We also thought about how we can reprogram the pavement. This is actually based on, as a concept, based on some work we've been doing in Toronto with the Waterford Toronto, how we can reprogram the road. So it means different things during the day. You can use it for different activities in the course of the day. And also we thought about something very, very important, which is how can we use all of this surface we have, which today is asphalt. You know, asphalt is not good because it simply gets very hot during the summer. It increases the urban heat island. So it absorbs a lot of heat from the sun and doesn't produce anything. And there's already quite a few, you know, systems in order to turn asphalt into photovoltaics. It's still a bit expensive, but then, you know, can you actually use that infrastructure, the moving infrastructure, to produce energy, which is then used really for the mobility that happens above it. So anyway, these were some of the ideas we developed as part of this project, Réinventer le Périphérique, reinventing the peripheric. Again about the ring road, the highway ring road in Paris. And, you know, they were exhibited in Paris until a few months ago, and hopefully they will be part of the discussion of how this giant piece of infrastructure could be repurposed in the future.
That's interesting. What I'm realizing while you're talking is that you have redesigned the infrastructure, and as a result, there might be a redesign of the mobility. Is that sort of the causal relationship? Do you first change the infrastructure and then you then sort of facilitate different kind of mobility? Or could you also do it the other way around?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, normally, traditionally, actually, first of all, we got flows, you know, flows of people. If you think about the past, you know, it's flows of people, flows of animals, flows of vehicles. And then, you know, we build roads around it. So I think, you know, basically traditionally this is how things have been developed. But in this case, you know, we got this giant piece of infrastructure that was built in the past century. And certainly the city at the time was all vehicle centric, was all car centric. You know, the car was at the core of the 20th century city. We're talking about Paris. Well, you know, in the 1920s, Le Corbusier, a great French architect, you know, proposed to actually demolish the whole city and just build a new city. It was built around the automobile. And so because of this, because we're looking at the legacy from the past century, and because mobility is changing so fast, again, we talked about AVs and DVs, autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles a moment ago, but I think there's many other things we can discuss now about how mobility is changing because of data, because of micromobility, because of new ways to share vehicles. Then because of all of this, then the question is, how can you in turn start planning new infrastructure? So, you know, I would say you're right. You know, usually the infrastructure follows. But in this case, when you want to plan ahead in the next 20 or 30 years, you need to do an exercise to start imagining how the infrastructure also could be adapted from today to the new mobility forms we will see tomorrow.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think we started this podcast thinking about a radical redesign, but we are, of course, somewhat limited by the infrastructure that's currently in place in Amsterdam if we don't want to rebuild the entire city.
We could actually close all of the canals and do highways through the city.
That would be your radical redesign.
That was the plan in the 60s.
Actually, in the 60s, I'll tell you that there was a group of radical architects, Italian architects, that were called Super Studio. And they had a project for Venice. And they actually proposed to cover all of Venice with something that in Italian is called vetrocemento, but it's basically this kind of greenish glass. It took over all the canals so they could become urban highways and look a little bit like canals. So, you know, we could still propose this also for Amsterdam.
Okay, I don't know if we really want to go into that direction. I hadn't disclosed it to you, but I'm actually a citizen of Amsterdam. So I really want to sort of stir this conversation into another direction now.
No, this was, you know, just a joke, but I think, you know, you're right. You know, Amsterdam's infrastructure is amazing. It's beautiful. It's why we all love Amsterdam with all of its canals. And so I think the question in Amsterdam to me seems more, how could Amsterdam be leading the way into developing new mobility solutions that follows its infrastructure?
Yeah, you know, it's so unique. Now I get really, because I loved like your work you did in Zaragoza, and you're trying to use the imagination a lot of times in your work. I've been like doing a lot of research about your work. Like, if you would use that, you've been to Amsterdam, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. No, I spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. I love Amsterdam. You know, if I think about the cities where...
Yeah, that's what... If you would use your imagination, where would you redesign then? Where do you think the next steps would have to go?
In this case, you know, as you were saying, you know, we got the beautiful infrastructure from the past. And this infrastructure means there's a lot of water, a lot of canals. And, you know, and then the place for mobility, for pedestrian or vehicular mobility is quite small. And to me, then Amsterdam is beautifully positioned to be at the forefront of two new revolutions happening in mobility. The first one is what I think is going to happen more and more in cities around the world, which is micromobility. Micromobility means all the e-bikes and scooters that we've seen in cities all over the world, that you can take them anywhere, you can leave them anywhere. There's many companies that have been doing this over the past 3 to 5 years. And this is probably phase one, but I think we're going to see more and more micromobility. So very small mobility, clean mobility, electric mobility that can help us to move for, you know, 1 or 2 miles. And by the way, if you look at something like New York, in New York, most trips are really under 2 miles. And for under 2 miles, you really don't want to use a car or a vehicle. It's total nonsense. It's a huge amount of, you know, energy you need. You use a lot of space. You lose a lot of money. There's a lot of energy embedded in the vehicle, let alone the energy you need to move it. So, you know, you don't want to do it. You want to do something much more nimble. And micromobility, I think, is starting to address this.
Do you still think we should increase it? Because we are one of the most bicycle-friendly cities in the world, to come together with Copenhagen and a couple of other cities. So our micromobility, I bring up my kids. I've got 4 kids and they're all going with their bike to school. So do you say, okay, you guys should actually still improve your bicycle and micromobility and sharing micromobility? You should even go further than you've already done?
Well, what I would say is that actually that you're totally right. So, you know, somehow bicycle mobility, Amsterdam and Copenhagen have been two of the leading cities together with other cities around the world. But, you know, if you look at micromobility, the interesting thing is that you can have vehicles that you can take wherever you want. You can leave them wherever you want. Today, we're looking at, you know, scooters and the e-bikes and normal bikes. But, you know, I think we're going to see more and more new versions, you know, new forms of this. And again, this is enabled by digital. It's enabled by data that allows you to take the bike or the scooter wherever you want, to leave it wherever you want, and to do the last mile or the last 2 miles. So I think, you know, that is certainly something that's going to change the face of cities all over the world. By the way, I was talking to the mayors of a few large cities recently, you know, from Milan to New York, and they are actually planning to use a lot of micromobility in the next months because of really to recover from coronavirus. So micromobility is going to be very important, both in recovering from the lockdown, but also in the longer term, I believe. And so
and
I think Amsterdam
a lot of questions comes along with, let's say, micro mobility and how to use public space and how to use the data. But let's first of all go into the second thing you think could be changed and not go into depth on one level. Let's say, okay, micro mobility is one thing that's going to change.
I'll mention the second one in a second, just to finish it, just to wrap it up on micro mobility. So I think, you know, Amsterdam is beautifully positioned for two reasons. As you said, first, that it's also one of the leading cities for bikes in the past and today. And the other thing is that really, you know, you don't have enough space, at least in the city center. You know, you don't have big roads, you have, you know, small space. And so actually that constraints can become like, you know, an advantage in being creative about new mobility systems. Now, the other thing is clearly water. And, you know, water has been used as a way to move people around in Amsterdam for a long time. And water, I believe, can be used again in a different way because of new technologies. And one of the projects, the key project we've been working on with AMS, as part of AMS, is something called Rowboat. And Rowboat is about thinking about boats.
Yeah, I saw that. It was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I saw it. No, it's just a compliment, but it's just... We haven't been using the water for a long time. It's only been using for tourists and canals, but not for using to carry freight anymore. And I saw your MIT or whatever it was, and it was robot, and they were all going by itself. And suddenly you saw something we didn't even see ourselves anymore because we got so much water, but we don't actually use that infrastructure anymore. Not that often, let's say. I was really stunned.
But thank you. And you know, we're very excited about the project as well. By the way, we started 4 years ago. It is one of the leading projects worldwide when you look at autonomous mobility on water. And I think, you know, it's about, you know, this is an infrastructure you've been using for centuries. You've been using first for moving people, for moving, you know, goods around. If you look at all the old homes from Amsterdam, you know, they all have the way to collect things from the barges and from the water. And today it's underused. It's used a bit for tourists, but no, otherwise it's underused. So in order to use it better, we probably need to design a new mobility system. And Robot is trying to go in that direction. So it's about very small pods. They are autonomous, so anybody can use them. So you don't need to be able to drive to be a sailor to use them. And they're small pods, and also the small pods can connect with each other. So you can actually create different shapes, smaller and bigger. And you can also use them as a temporary infrastructure, as a temporary bridge between the city. You can use them as a floating platform for a concert. So again, it's about using new technologies to create like a dynamic, responsive water infrastructure that again can be developed in Amsterdam because of its unique and beautiful configuration, but then probably useful also for many other cities because most of the cities on the planet are facing some kind of body of water. It can be a lake, can be the sea, can be a river. You know, most cities have been developed there because water is essential to human life.
You said in the Paris thing about the autonomous, and then the everybody in Amsterdam, I hear that a lot of experts, including myself, to be quite honest, they are with the autonomous vehicles with only one person in it. I talked to the big researcher who's running the whole research thing of Nissan in San Francisco at this moment, also says, okay, very nice. But if in Amsterdam or even in the periphérique, there's one person in one vehicle, that does not solve this congestion thing. Even it gets better to be in that autonomous, maybe electric car, but that does not solve the problem. How do we get in those urban areas just from where you cannot bike anymore, when you just go a little bit further? How do you see that with this autonomous with one person in it?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me add a little thing about micromobility. You know, really the key thing about micromobility, you know, even the micromobility we have today, let alone new systems, allows you to go further away. So, for instance, if you think about Beijing, well, in Beijing, if you go from Wangfujing to the Olympic Stadium, and you're talking about tens of kilometers, and clearly you cannot do that every day by bike, but you can do it if you got an e-bike. So if you got something, you know, which helps, you know, supplements human power with additional power. So the first thing is actually that thanks to micromobility, we can also somehow increase the range which can reach, not only what we could do once upon a time with bicycle, but actually we can actually, it's almost like the city is shrinking and we can go further. But beyond that, your point is totally, totally well taken. It's very important about, cars, you can have autonomous cars and then, if you got one person inside, is a lot of wasted space inside the car and wasted usage of the urban infrastructure. Now, just to let you know about cars, how inefficient cars are today and how they were in the 20th century, it's starting to change now, but until today, a car on average is not used 95% of the time. It's used only 5% of the time. 95% of the time, it's parked somewhere with actually using valuable space in our cities. And do you know what? You're using 5% of the time, and at 5% of the time, most of the time, as you're saying, there's one or two people inside. On average, 1.6.
Yeah, but then I saw this project, what you're doing in Singapore. It looks great. And I saw what you're doing in New York with the data. And you're figuring out, then you're saying on the website what I found really interesting, but you're saying that, okay, if we go into autonomous, suddenly this will be solved. So I'm puzzling.
No. Let me say more details. So the point is that, as I was saying, today is very inefficient. So as I was saying, 5% usage and, 1.6 people out of 5 people. So you're talking about something, the overall efficiency of the whole mobility system based on cars is less than 2%. Now you move to autonomy and the efficiency can be the same, can be even worse, but it can also be much, much better. So what is the difference with autonomy? The difference with autonomy is both ride sharing and car sharing. Let's start from car sharing. Car sharing, we know it today. It means, that you can take an app, look at a car, say car to go next to you, Zipcar in the United States, but same thing. You go to the car, you get it, you use it, and you leave it somewhere else. Now, it is estimated that every car to go, every car shared, can actually remove between 10 and 30 vehicles from the street. Because instead of being one car parked somewhere, you keep on using it. You use it, and then, her uses it, Karen uses it, and many other people use it. So the first thing is that, you can do it. Now, autonomy allows you to do car sharing much better. Because with autonomy, you don't even need to go and look for the car. The car comes to you and takes you where you need to go. And then it parks itself. So it makes car sharing much, much easier. At the same time, autonomy also allows you much better ride sharing. And, actually some of our work, the work we did at MIT, is a part of the work, that led to a large collaboration with Uber. As Uber launched Uber Pool a few years ago that allows people to share the ride. So ride sharing has been really a big thing over the past few years. Ride share is interesting. Instead of two cars, you get one car and two people sharing the car. So it's an interesting thing for the city and for people who you might meet up also interesting people during the ride. Well, again, with self-driving cars, that becomes easier. With intelligent algorithms, the car can pick up different people and take them to destination, and you can share the vehicle better. You
have more on a higher level, what kind of design principles do you look at if you start redesigning a city? What are the principles where you think a livable, sustainable city should be? Like, you start off...
I wanted to finish first, your question before, which is... is autonomy going to solve what happens if people, you have only one person inside the car? So just to finish this point.
Yeah,
so
okay.
As I'm saying, autonomy allows us to do more car sharing and ride sharing. Now, are we going to do it? If we are going to do it, we can theoretically run a city such as New York or London or Amsterdam or Milan with around 20% of the vehicles we have today. That is possible. At the same time, we can have a city where everybody is alone on her or his, self-driving car. And then, basically what happens is that it's going to be even more congested than today. The difference between those two conditions, same technology, but two totally different conditions, are actually the decisions that the city will take. But basically, decisions about how we are going to run the city is what is going to determine if you're going to end up with more or less car. Technology can take us anywhere. But I think it's up to us to decide if we want more or less cars. Well, the good news, autonomous car allows us to have less cars on the road.
Can I ask just a clarifying question? Because I'm beginning sort of to wonder, what is your definition of autonomy? Because maybe we are using different definitions.
Yeah, usually people define autonomous car or a self-driving car like a car that, can move on its own. And so basically a car can come and pick you up and take you to your destination, basically without human intervention. That's the definition of autonomy. Now, there's different levels of autonomy. This is autonomy level 5, the highest level of autonomy. If you think about what a Tesla is today, for instance, or other cars, they're not there yet. So, you know, they still need a driver to be behind the steering wheel. But autonomy is really when the car can really become a mobility platform that can collect you anywhere and take you anywhere.
I totally understand the last thing you said. It's a choice in which way you want to use the, let's say, whatever level the autonomy is, for actually saying we want to reduce the amount of cars and we want to have a new system in. Or you say the system is going to run itself autonomous with only one car. That's a big choice. Actually, what I hear you say, that, and the choice can be made in design, or the choice can be made by a municipality. But there is a that can go both ways. Is that a right interpretation of your words? You say no, you did not understand it fully. I meant something else.
No. You exactly as you're saying. So every technology can be used for different things. You know, like a knife can be used for eating better or for killing someone. In the same way, a self-driving car can be used to reduce the total number of cars, or even to increase it under certain conditions. And so there, the important thing will be the decisions that city halls, that mayors all around the world, city administrations, CTOs will take. And actually, and I think, you know, for instance, let me elaborate on the type of interesting decisions that people will have to take. Is that, you know, if you look at the income coming from vehicles today, it comes from taxation because of parking, and also taxation because of fuel, of gas. Well, you know, both of them are most likely going to evaporate. If you go self-driving cars, parking can be reduced a lot. And also, you know, especially if you do EVs, electric vehicles, you're not going to have traditional taxes on gas. Now, so what is going to provide revenues to cities and governments? Well, most likely is the use of infrastructure, a bit like Singapore has been doing, which basically say it depends on how many miles you travel on the road. And if it is congested or not, then you pay a fee. You use an infrastructure.
Charge.
You use a, well, it's congestion charge, but it's also based on usage. It's not, you know, the kind of old fashioned way that some European cities have been doing, but it's more really like, you know, a dynamic way where you're paying for the usage. You pay as you go because you're using the road. And if you think about that, then clearly we can actually put in place the right dynamic road pricing schemes in order to make sure that actually we are achieving the goals we want to have. And, you know, I think citizens should be part of the decision. But, you know, if you want to have less cars, we can certainly do it by making sure that people need to pay more in order to use the road. And then more people will share the car and more people will use micromobility. And then you will achieve that goal. Again, data will be instrumental in order to see where we want to go. But people need to decide the goal and communicate it to their mayors and their administrators.
Let's go into the data thing. That's really your thing always, Karin. What kind of question have you got on, like, data is a big thing for Mr. Rotti too. Like, what are your question on the data thing, Karin?
Well, I was intrigued by many of your projects. Agar, I got the feeling that you, before you design anything, you also look at the data available and start analyzing certain flows, etc. So I really wanted to pick your brain. What type of data are you looking at, and what are the current possibilities of analyzing that and understanding the movements?
So data today is very interesting because it can help us to understand dimensions of the city that we couldn't understand just a few years ago. Also, data is the enabler for artificial intelligence. You know, many people today talk about AI, how we can use AI in cities. Well, you know, there's no AI whatsoever unless we have data that the AI can understand and process.
We're sort of talking about that some of these developments are digitally enabled. Are there any sort of technological developments that you see on the horizon that will shape mobility as we know it?
Well, you know, we've been talking about some of the changes about, you know, for traditional vehicles, for cars, about AVs and DVs, autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles. I think the same can be applied to many other dimensions. Again, you know, we said about autonomous boats, but there's also autonomy in the sky. Now, to be honest, I don't believe that autonomous drones will be the future in our cities. I think drones can have a role to play in sparsely populated urban areas. You know, they have a certainly role to play where there's no infrastructure. Very interesting experiments going on right now in Africa with drones. I don't think really drones would be the future for massive mobility, but drones can play a role, you know, for delivering things which are time sensitive, for medicine, for sensing the city as well. So certainly some of these changes. Again, you know, we're talking about all of this is really about data and artificial intelligence.
Are there any data elements when it comes to mobility that you'd love to listen to or get your hands on that are currently unavailable to you?
Oh, well, you know, the amount of data we're getting is becoming richer and richer every day. You know, when we started actually back in 2006, one of the first projects from our lab that's now 14 years ago, we did was actually the first time ever that we looked at a lot of cell phone data in order to see how a city moves in real time. That had never been done at the time. You know, some of the things that we still do today on our iPhones are based on some of the initial papers and patents we did at the time. And so if you look at that at the time, we had, however, data, something like, you know, 10 or 20 data points per person per day. Now, if you move fast forward today, the same type of data is one or two orders of magnitude richer. So the amount of data is incredibly denser today. And plus, we have many other types of data that have been generated in the meanwhile. So somehow we are getting more and more data describing our cities to the point that when we started in 2006, you know, we thought that this was very interesting data, but also problematic for privacy. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, today that's 10 or 100 times more problematic, because at the time, you know, it was really coarse and, you know, you're still in it was resolution was very low. Today, you know, really getting almost like a digital copy of everybody's life. And I think, you know, that's another important thing we should discuss. The data is great. Data is the input to artificial intelligence, but we need to be very cautious about how we use data and be very transparent about what we apply to it.
What does a municipality what is their role in this data thing?
Well, the municipality can play different roles. So a role that has been played by many municipalities, what I mentioned about New York is, you know, this part of big movement of open data. The move of open data was started by the Obama administration after the beginning of the second Obama administration, and many cities around the world started sharing data. Now, open data is great, and open data can apply to all of the data that today cities already collect. But usually, you know, they don't really share easily. There's a lot of data about homes, about real estate, about mobility that, you know, the cities collect, but, you know, traditionally this data was not shared. So then open data there is great. Now, some people think that all the data should be open data. But, you know, if you were to open the data, all the data that your phone, your iPhone or smartphone collects about you every day, you're basically sharing, you know, like a digital copy of your life. You know, everybody, anybody would know in real time exactly where you are with an accuracy of probably 1 or 2 meters. So I don't think we can open up all the data sets we have. And so we need different kind of preferences about how we open the data and what it is used for. And I think here, both cities and national governments and supranational governments, such as the European Union with GDPR, can really play a big role about how data should be used and what for. And the key thing for me, you know, there's many things we could discuss. There's not what just, you know, one solution about how to use data. But the key thing is really we should be transparent. Today, we are lacking a lot of transparency. You know, people, a lot of companies collect our data, and, you know, they're not transparent about how they use it. I think, you know, cities can really force a lot of transparency in the way data is collected.
What does concrete force mean? Does it mean, I always say, okay, Karin is the operator of Uber or whatever, and she comes to Amsterdam and you are the municipality. Let's play those roles. And what do you mean with forcing? Do they have to open their data when they
want to? No, as I was saying, you know, again, we need to be very, very careful. We cannot open every data. So see, municipalities should do, as I was saying, two things. Take the data they already have and open it up. Most of the data is data that's not sensitive in terms of privacy. It's data that today you can get, but in order to get it, you might need, you know, one day asking through paper, going through paperwork in a municipality office in order to get hold of the data. So all of that should be opened up and easily be accessible with the click of a mouse. Now, on the other hand, I think municipalities can actually set new rules. And, you know, for instance, I think about Airbnb. It would be very important to get information about Airbnb and, you know, the usage of the city through Airbnb. So cities can actually make sure that companies such as Airbnb or Uber as well, for the matter, or Lyft, you know, mobility companies as well, they say, you know, well, if you operate, usually, you know, in the same way as cities legislate in order to say you want to be have a taxi, well, you need to follow certain rules. Well, you know, to be an operator of mobility, an operator like Airbnb about, you know, using space, then, you know, you need to follow certain rules. You need to share your data, and we need to monitor exactly what you're doing, and citizens need to be aware of it. You know, that's just a matter of transparency that I think it's very, very important.
And you feel that the municipality should actually take that role and set those ground rules?
Well, you know, this role is being taken at different levels in government. But when you look at, for instance, in mobility, traditionally, it has been municipalities to decide, you know, how many taxi licenses you're going to grant. And so I think it should be municipalities to say to any operator, you want to operate in my city, but you need to follow A, B, C, D. Now, what A, B, C, D are should be discussed, should be a matter of open discussion with citizens. But certainly, I think it should be municipalities to play that role, as they've been doing in the past with a lot of urban mobility.
Based on your experience all over the world, do you see any cities or places in the world where you say, okay, they're really front runners in organizing that digital domain or infrastructure as far as mobility is concerned?
Look, I was very impressed a few years ago when Mike Bloomberg was the mayor of New York. And the reason for that is that Mike Bloomberg, as I mentioned, you know, he built a giant, very successful company, a major company, Bloomberg, using data. And so he was really, really data savvy himself. And so a lot of his policy making was really based on data. So he opened up data, he used data to decide what to do. I even remember, you know, we were involved in a couple of projects in New York with his administration. And, you know, data was really, was used in a very, very sophisticated way. I think that was coming from his knowledge. And by the way, I just heard yesterday here in the United States that he's going to help a lot also with using data in order to reopen up New York City following the lockdown because of coronavirus. And I think that's, again, one way to use data in a very sophisticated way to help people go back to work without hopefully getting infected or minimizing infections. We've also been working a lot with Singapore. We've been running a lab in Singapore for almost 10 years now. And a lot of our work on data in Singapore has actually found, you know, a very receptive government. So we started with a project now at this point, probably 9 years ago, called Live Singapore, real-time data from all over the city. We showed it. We made a proof of concept. And actually that led the government to launch a number of initiatives that were built upon that the initial proof of concept. So I think, you know, there's many, many cities and governments. We talked enough probably about Amsterdam, but I think what the CTO's office in Amsterdam has been doing has opened the way also to a lot of innovation in different directions. So I think, you know, there's different cities. The good news is that cities are trying different things, and it should be so because it's an innovation ecosystem. So you want to have different CTOs, different cities, trying different ways to manage this new digital dimension. And then we need to share experiences and hopefully, you know, converge into best practices.
And the other way around, like if a city doesn't do anything about it, what's the horror situation where you maybe see they are, of course, we know what happened to our Airbnb, but maybe other ones where you think, oh, that is going into the wrong direction.
Well, you know, it can go to, so if you don't do anything, I think, you know, you will be just, you know, the future will come from somewhere else and you will be just, you know, the periphery. You will basically, the future will arrive later and you'll be less competitive. So I think you don't have an option not to do anything. If you don't do anything, you don't risk. If you don't do anything, I mean, if also you don't allow, say, Uber or Airbnb, you keep them out and you keep on keeping the 20th century, then, you know, but you're getting with a city that's not competitive. And one day when the future arrives, it will be much more disruptive. Now, if you allow innovation to come, you need to manage it. There's no way around. And if you don't do it, if you're slow, look, even if you manage it and you're a bit slow, problems can rise. Think about, you know, we're talking about scooters, where scooters are potentially very interesting. They can reduce, you know, car trips inside the city. They can be more sustainable. They reduce the use of the infrastructure. But, you know, in many cities around the world where, you know, administrations let scooters and e-bike come in without regulating them, we ended up with this new problem of, you know, bike pollution. Bikes everywhere. In China, you know, you've got bike cemeteries in cities where, you know, they threw into cities, you know, tens of thousands of bikes, floating bikes. You know, you could take them anywhere, leave them anywhere. You know, in the end, you know, they created sometimes very major problems. So I think, you know, you need to experiment. If you experiment, you need to be very, very quick in order to be able to change regulations and constantly have a feedback loop with innovation.
Now, I was triggered by something that I read where you said that technology alone is not going to sort of solve all the issues. We also have to really involve the citizens or the people in creating this bottom-up development, maybe, or a bottom-up empowerment. So how do you involve citizens or people in your scientific research or in your projects that you're doing?
Well, you know, again, the good news here is that digital, and we've been talking a lot about data, but data, you know, data is collected today through digital networks, and digital networks allow us really to engage people and citizens in new ways. For instance, here in Boston, we got a project. It's a project that has been going on for a number of years. It's called New Urban Mechanics. You know, the idea is to make turn citizens into mechanics of the city. And so making sure the citizen can make suggestions on how to change the city, can take action to, you know, to report things that have to be fixed. So somehow, you know, how we can leverage the power of networks today in order to engage people better. You know, participation, urban participation is nothing new. You know, cities are built around participation. And here is a way to use, again, new technologies in order to streamline an old process.
And then finally, sort of tuning into what's currently going on, the corona crisis. I know that you've been super busy with your Cura project. How is that going?
In order to respond to the crisis, we need more ICUs, intensive care units. And we started thinking how to do it, how to scale up. So we developed a design. We put it on open source. We started building a community. Again, the same point we were making before, how to bring people together, leveraging networks. And, you know, and then the community initially for designing was around 100 people. Then it quickly grew after we made it public to over 1,000 people. And so we got this kind of design for using shipping containers and turning them into ICUs with negative pressure, so with biocontainment. This is something that wasn't there before, and now it's been replicated in many countries around the world. So somehow is how to develop a piece of code to fight the code of the virus. The virus is DNA, is code, and it's replicating and attacking us. And how we can actually develop code, in this case about intelligence, about drawings, in this case about design, that can be replicated in order to fight back. The first unit of Cura, it's curapods.org, and the first one you can see there. The first one was just installed a couple of days ago in northern Italy. But as I said, you know, many groups and many people, many teams around the world are building similar things, just downloading the drawing, contributing to them, changing them, again, in a collaborative open source effort that would not have been possible without digital networks.
Do you think that this experience will fundamentally change the mobility system as we know it?
I don't think that this experience will change cities in the long term, but for the fact that it will accelerate transformations we were already seeing. So certainly, you know, we were already seeing a lot of smart working, flexible working. That's going to be accelerated. But I think cities are much more resilient. Look, you know, if you think about Venice in the 14th century, Venice lost 40% of its population because of the plague, the Black Plague, and still, we still live in Venice. We still love its little streets. You know, we've been living it for hundreds of years. And, you know, the plague in the 14th century was one of the many, many, many plagues that affected the city over the course of the century. And so the city has been very resilient. And somehow I think cities will come back stronger than before. But what we are seeing today might accelerate some of those transformations that had already started before, such as digital working.
Yeah, very clear. Maybe what comes up to my mind, I saw a couple of weird summarizing and ending this podcast. So I was looking at one of your TED Talks and I had to laugh because you were telling an anecdote about 2006 when you guys won the World Cup. And you were looking at the data, analyzing the data of Rome, and that you were seeing that everybody, of course, when the first half was over that everybody went in and just had a laugh or a beer. And then when you guys were scoring, that suddenly everybody went out and there was a huge thing going on. What I liked about it that, yes, of course, you see the data from the cell phones and you see guys celebrating. But what I find difficult sometimes, and I'm still curious, that we can actually see all that data, and it's funny. But on the other hand, what does it say? How can we interpret it? And so I've got a feeling that we just got a glimpse of what we can do with the data and what we can even... Sometimes I can't even get it into my own mind with what computers and algorithms can figure out what we can do. And sometimes I've got a feeling we're looking at this data and we haven't even started. If I see the imagination programs you are running, it's like I'm not there with my head what the possibilities of the data things could be. Could you just, at the end of the interview, still say, okay, these things I've got in my mind and I haven't even dared to share?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you're referring to this kind of map of Rome that we did. We're using cell phone data that I showed at TED. You know, in that case, we deliberately focus on using data to quantify something we knew, a phenomenon that we knew was there, which was about how the city moved, but we could actually quantify it. You know, even in that case, yes, and if you just look at it, it doesn't tell you much more than what you anecdotally know, but because you measure it, then it's a different thing. You can actually start using the data for policy decisions. But, you know, but there's many other unexpected things that we've discovered on that type of data, on other types of data, how we can streamline the city, how we can better serve with mobility underserved communities, how we can make sure that public transportation is accessible in a uniform way across the city. We've done this analysis not only in Rome, but also in Singapore, in other cities around the world. So I think data really means you understand better something, you understand better a city. And that understanding is the first step to change it.
Carlo, thanks very much in joining us from all the way from the other side of the world. It was a pleasure from Karen's side and from my side too. And for everybody who's been listening, we will put in the show notes a couple of these projects so you can actually straight go to Carlo Rotti's website, or maybe we put the TEDx YouTube thing in, and you can actually, I really would recommend everybody listening to actually look at a couple of things, because the imagination of what it can bring, that is, I think, the future. So thanks a lot, and people can react on with an email to geert@geertkloppenburg.nl if they want to. And my producer always says that if you can give a review in the podcast app by iTunes, if you liked this podcast, that would be really, really nice. Karen, have you ever done that, given a review?
Not on podcasts.
No, Mira, it's quite simple, to be honest. You just can give 1 star to 5 stars. Of course, you would like to have 5, or you can make a short comment. And on the other hand, what makes life really easy, you can subscribe. If you are in your favorite podcast app, you can subscribe to this Metropolitan Mobility Podcast for free, and you get the next episode for free. I've subscribed to many different podcasts, and that's what I really like, so I get these ones automatically. Have you done that, Karen, or you just...
No, I've got many subscriptions, but this is sort of turning into our Telcel moment where we're sort of
we both hate it, I know. Yeah. And Carlo Rotti, thanks everybody, thanks, stay safe for everybody wherever you are. Carlo, thanks a lot. Karen, thanks a lot. Cheerio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be right back.